I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And this is Red Handed, and welcome to our first ever cult episode.
I know, I can't believe it took us, almost 30 episodes to do a cult?
Yeah, that is weird, actually. So we've got a pretty good one for you today. I think it is lesser known, which is quite difficult with cults. Like, the interesting ones are usually broadcast all over everywhere. But this one, I didn't know about this one until quite recently. This cult have been called the Narco Satanistas and the Believers in the press. But it would appear they had no name for themselves.
That's almost more terrifying and more like how seriously they take it. They haven't just given themselves some fucking stupid name. They're just there to do business. Cult business.
Yeah, they're like, this is just my life. This is not anything weird. I don't need a name for it.
I think that's even scarier.
So we're in the late 80s in Matamoros, Mexico. Because it is our first cult, let's have a quick look at what actually you need for something to be a cult in the first place. And the leading paper on this was written by Robert J. Liftons as his psychiatrist. And I think it's in 1980 and it's called Cult Formation. And basically he says that cults need three things to really be cult. So the first thing you need is a charismatic leader who increasingly becomes an object of worship as the general principles that may have originally sustained the group lose power. This leader has to be alive and they have no meaningful accountability. And this becomes the single most defining element of the group and its source of power and authority. So that's classic. You need the charismatic leader. Number two, you need a process of indoctrination or education that's in use and can be seen as coercive persuasion or thought reform. So that's brainwashing, basically. That's number two. And then number three, you need economic, sexual and other exploitation of group members by the leader and the ruling people in the group. And these guys definitely have all three. But I did think that the living leader thing was quite interesting, because does Scientology stop being a cult just because L. Ron Hubbard is dead?
But then when does a cult stop being a cult and become a religion? They claim they're a religion, but I'd call them a cult. But then I'd call most religions cults, cultish. And so I don't know, does it just go from being a cult to being a religion now that he's dead and they have tax exempt, you know, status?
Yeah, and then I also think, I mean, David Miscavige is doing a pretty good job of keeping that flame alive. So maybe he's just taken, can you pass it on? Does it have to be the same charismatic leader, or can you just, because when you see like the famous cult, like the Source family ended when their leader ended, that was it, he died.
But then the Children of God cult, that was founded by David Berg, he's dead now, isn't he? And they just rebranded and they're like, we're the Family International. But I don't even think the rebranding or the change was because he died, it was because of all of the sex abuse. So I don't know. And David Miscavige, he is definitely the leader now, but they don't sort of deify him, do they? They don't like admire him as a godlike person. It was L. Ron Hubbard that they still think of as that, even though he's dead. But then if you think also, doesn't it come down to what that cult believes? Because don't Scientology believe, like, is he even dead as far as they're concerned? I don't know. Like energy, organs.
Oh yeah, they've got that whole thing.
I don't know.
It's terrifying.
Oh God. Cult. It's a cult.
It's such a cult. Like I was in LA and they literally flyer people on the street. They have people standing on the street with flyers.
But then Hannah standing next to him will be a Christian guy. Standing next to him will be a fucking Hare Krishna guy. Like, they're all cults.
But obviously you do have Christians on street corners who like have signs that say like Jesus loves you and will try and hand you copies of the Watchtower or whatever. Like, obviously that.
Hare Krishnas, all of them.
Yeah. Obviously you do have that. But I do remember the Scientologist flyer being particularly aggressive. And like it stood out in my mind as different to things I had seen with other religions, is all I mean.
Do you feel like it's because the aggressive expansion of mainstream religions took place hundreds of years ago, and now they're like, we're good, we got a stable foundation, we'll continue to grow where we can? But Scientologists needs to grow now, because it's almost in that part, the time of a religion or a cult when it needs to experience rapid growth.
I think the thing about Scientology is like, it's a business, like
it's a big pyramid scheme.
Yeah, so like, I think,
but then what isn't?
So if you look at it from an economic standpoint, it's exactly the same. Like, they need rapid growth now.
But then, you know, I'd say that same thing about the church back in the day, any religion back in the day, even now, because you know, I basically think we live in a world where, whether it's a cult or whether it's a mainstream religion, we live in a world where it's like belief and faith and worship have been commodified. What religion could you join now where you're not being, look at those super churches and things like that. This is not coming down on Christianity or one religion over the other. In my opinion, they all have elements of that. And, you know, your personal beliefs are one thing, but organized religion can certainly be exploitative, is all I'm saying. So with this cult, or this group, whatever you want to call them, they were led by a high priest who they called El Padrino, or the Godfather, who led them in their rites of cleansing, witchcraft, protection, and human sacrifice. Now, under the instructions of El Padrino, his followers would abduct anyone he wanted, believing that his human sacrifices made the group invincible. And you can even see video footage of them. They really, really believed that they were untouchable. And it's one of the weirdest parts of this whole case, like how strongly they believe that. And their depraved religious rites went unnoticed for years. And to this day, no one really knows just how many people lost their lives under the machete of El Padrino. The most important thing to understand about Matamoros is that it's just over the border from Brownsville, Texas. Literally, you can just walk over a bridge from Texas and be in Matamoros. In Mexico, the drinking age is only 16. This made Matamoros a very, very attractive prospect for spring breakers. I mean, it's like Zante for North Americans.
Yeah, but you can't walk to Zante.
Yes, it's like if you could walk to Zante, if that easy jet flight to Zante was just a bridge for North Americans, that's what it feels like. Ooh, and it feels like even younger because you can go from 16 and get smashed there. So obviously, as you can imagine, students flocked there and they could stay in super cheap hotels or they could just leave their cars in the United States, walk over the bridge, party in Matamoros in Calle Alvaro Abrego, consistently full of revelers, buying Coronas just for like a dollar. And on the 11th of March, 1989, Mark Kilroy and his friends were partying. Now, Mark was a senior at the University of Texas at Austin. His friends, Bill Huddleston and Bradley Moore, were both juniors at Texas A&M. And his fourth friend, Brent Martin, was a student at Alvin Community College. They'd all played basketball together in high school at Santa Fe, Texas. Mark Kilroy was 21 and a pretty good-looking boy.
The four mates party, they talk to girls, one of whom, and this is noted in almost every article I read, which is bizarre, one of the girls that Mark was talking to came second in a Miss Tanline competition. Why is that important?
I don't know. It's what, the 80s in spring break Mexico?
I think they're kind of making the point like, oh, he was that good looking. He was talking to a Miss Tanline runner-up. Like, I think that's why.
Got it.
He leaves Miss Tanline eventually and they end up back at their hotel at about 2:30 in the morning. So they're in Mexico this night. The next day they return to Texas and they dropped in on a frat party in the evening, but they actually decided they'd rather go back to Matamoros. But this time they parked their cars on the US side of the border and crossed the bridge over the Rio Grande on foot.
Also, love, imagine being able to party that hard anymore. Like, I know they're like 21, but seriously, they go out in Matamoros, getting smashed on $1 Coronas. Probably the alcohol there isn't great as well. Then the next day, they just go to a frat party and then head back to Mexico. Like, I went out one night on New Year's Eve here and I was hungover for 3 days. Like, that's unbelievable to me. Unbelievable.
I also just wish I lived somewhere. I'd be like, oh, should we just go to Mexico? It's only half an hour.
Like, I guess we could be like, want to go to...
No, we can't. We can't go anywhere fun.
Spain? We can't go anywhere fun. I actually think we've got a better deal. We've got the whole of Europe.
Yeah, but you can't walk there.
Yeah, I mean, Brexit. Hey, you know they're starting a direct train Eurostar from London to Amsterdam, though.
Oh, that'd be fun.
I mean, it'll cost like hundreds of pounds, but it's happening.
I've never been on the Eurostar. I always just do the Channel Tunnel.
It's really expensive. It's cheaper to fly.
Yeah, flying's such a pain in the arse, though.
And then now we're going to fucking be even harder because we'll have those bloody blue passports and they'll probably make us not be allowed to go through with the other EU citizens anymore.
Oh, for God's sake. Why? Anyway, the four boys get loose for a few hours and then they decide to head back over the river to get their cars.
Get loose. I like that.
You not heard me say that before? Get loose.
Get loose. Literally never heard you say that before.
Oh, what are you doing Friday night? I don't know, getting loose.
That's hilarious. It sounds like you're going to sleep around. getting loose. Anyway, no judgment, Hannah, no judgment.
Thanks.
Sorry, your mum listens. Carry on.
She's all right, she knows. So they head back to their cars, and we will find this in this case, like, there are usually about 2 to 3 versions of events. So we've got 2 accounts of what happened next. Number one, Mark hung back from the others because he needed a wee, so he went into the forest, into the woods, to go to the toilet, basically. Number two, he was called over by someone who his friends thought he knew. So this person was saying something like, didn't I just see you somewhere? Or something to that effect. So Mark goes over to this person to speak to them and the others go on ahead. Either way, whatever happened, Mark Kilroy did not cross the border with his friends. They backtracked a little bit to try and spot him, but after a while they assumed that he must have gone on ahead. So they crossed the bridge, went through customs, and were fully expecting to find Mark Kilroy already with their cars. But he was nowhere to be seen. And when they still had heard nothing by the next morning, Huddleston, Moore and Martin knew that something had to be wrong.
Students were often reported missing in Matamoros. They usually just turned up, though, a few days later, totally safe with nothing more than a brutal hangover and absolutely no memory of the nights before. And so, in this case, it just started off as a routine missing person story. But there would be no sign of Mark Kilroy. He didn't show up at any of the usual places, and the authorities on both sides of the Rio Grande began to suspect foul play. George Gavito was the deputy sheriff at Brownsville in Texas at the time, and due to their close proximity, Gavito had worked extremely closely with the Mexican police force for about 20 years, and surprisingly, experienced nothing but absolute beautiful cooperation. That was until Mark Kilroy went missing. And it just became like getting blood from a stone. The Matamoros Police Department simply told Gavito that Kilroy had been involved with narcotics, and that's why he'd gone missing. They refused to tell Gavito where they were getting this information from. So in other words, they were just saying he was playing with fire and he got burnt, that he was asking for whatever had happened to him. Gavito had a suspicion, though, that this was not the case. So Donald Wells, the US consul in Matamoros, was contacted, and pictures of Mark Kilroy were circulated in hospitals and jails. And Bradley Moore, who was Mark Kilroy's friend and with him the night that he had gone missing, was even placed under hypnosis and apparently remembered Mark Kilroy speaking to a young Hispanic man with a cut on his face. Kilroy's parents flew down to Brownsville to lead the search, and the case was even featured on America's Most Wanted.
I think it's really important, like with the hypnosis, like that's such a weird thing for a police department to do, but I think it shows how desperate they were, that they absolutely had nothing to go on. So Gavito knew that time was of the absolute essence here, because all of his potential witnesses would leave Matamoros in 3 days when spring break was over, and then there would be no hope.
It's like a movie.
It literally is. A student goes on spring break and is kidnapped by a cult. It is insanity. So Gavito made sure that Kilroy's face was on TV, in the papers, everywhere, and he kept it there as long as he could. But no leads surfaced, and Gavito had no choice but to call in the big guns. Luckily, Gavito had been working closely with Comandante Juan Benitez Ayala, the head of the federal police assigned to Matamoros. People were terrified of him, and they got the job done. Like, in the documentary, I'll post it on the Facebook group. Gavito's like this huge American guy from Texas, and he's talking about Comandante Ayala, and he's just like, he's 5 foot tall, but he stands 8 foot tall. He's terrifying. Like, so much so that, like, you would never see Ayala in a restaurant or in a bar. You would only see him when he was working, because he was dealing with like heavy duty narcotics trafficking cases. So he was taking out incredibly powerful people, and he was genuinely too afraid to go out in public. He thought if he went to a bar, his drink would be poisoned. Like, that's how important the people he was dealing with were. So Gavito explained that he had a missing persons case, and that the cooperation from the police department left a lot to be desired. And Ayala put his people to work, promising to hand over any leads he found straight to Gavito, because in Mexico, you don't need a search warrant when the federales are on your side. But despite the extra muscle and a reward of $20,000 being widely publicised, nothing was found, and no one had a clue where Mark Kilroy was. Dejected, Gavito went down to Comandante Ayala's office to discuss what their next move would be. And whilst he was waiting in the foyer, he heard a voice.
When Gavito turned round to see 22-year-old Serafin Hernandez, who he knew as a student in Brownsville, Gavito and Hernandez had crossed paths a few months earlier when Serafin reported his uncle, Elio Hernandez, to be missing. It's important to note that there are a lot of Mexican students in the area of Texas, and it's reasonably common for young Mexican students to lead totally different lives on either side of the border. We're going to see this in a massive way later on. Now, the Hernandez family were well known in Matamoros for drug smuggling. The ins and out of Elio's kidnapping were pretty murky, but it seems like it was written off again just as narcotics-related incident, which is why Serafin had sought the help of Gavito and the Brownsville Sheriff's Department. Now, Ayala explained that Serafin had been arrested because he failed to stop at a police roadblock. The police followed him to Rancho Santa Elena, owned by the Hernandez family, about 20 miles west of Matamoros. Police arrested Serafin Hernandez on the spot, and upon searching the ranch, the police found 250,000 pounds of marijuana. They also found a hut, but it was quite big, more like a small barn, I guess. And inside they saw what they described as brujería, or witchcraft. Officers described seeing candles, bottles of liqueur, and a large metal pot in the middle of the floor. There was also a caretaker at Santa Elena. He was placed under house arrest, and the police told him that they would be returning later to question him. Deputy Sheriff Gavito is at home when he receives a call from Comandante Alia at about 2 a.m. that morning, and they had found Mark Kilroy.
He was buried at the Santa Elena Ranch. His legs had been amputated at the knees, and his brain had been removed from his skull and was missing. Since Mark's disappearance, less than a month before, Matamoros police had been showing his picture to everybody they questioned, and the caretaker of Santa Elena was no exception. When shown Kilroy's picture, he calmly said that yes, he knew him, he had been here, and the caretaker even admitted to feeding Kilroy when he was tied up in the hut. When Serafin was shown the same picture, he said, "Yes, I know Mark. That's the guy everyone's looking for. I know him. I kidnapped him. He's buried at the ranch." Just as easy as that. He just tells this terrifying Comandante the truth. He's not afraid, and none of it seems to bother him at all.
Now, Gavito was stunned. He couldn't believe that Serafin Hernandez was willingly giving up this information. He even asked Ayala if he had to torture Hernandez for this information, but he hadn't. Hernandez was totally unafraid. He believed that he was literally bulletproof. The police could do no harm, and that El Padrino would swoop in at any minute to release him from this police custody. He genuinely thought he was invincible, and you can see it in his interviews with the police. He's so unbelievably calm. So the police took Serafin Hernandez back to Santa Elena the next day, so on the 11th of April 1989, and demanded that he show them where the body was buried, to which Hernandez replied, "Which body?" Now, Ayala is furious with the young man, who seems to show no remorse and have absolutely no concept of what he's done being wrong. Hernandez explained that why he was hesitating was that there were so many bodies buried at the ranch that he was simply asking which one the federales would like to be taken to. To which Ayala replies, "All of them." And what follows is so weird. Now, it's all on film. Serafin meanders around the yard outside the hut saying things like, "There's Gilberto, I don't know his last name," and he makes it look like it's just the most mundane task in the world. And at one point, he even asks the federales to order him some food because he's getting hungry. He's so unbelievably detached from basically the whole universe, it seems like. It's completely mind-blowing. He genuinely believed that he was untouchable. And even though he was giving the federales and the most feared comandante in the district a guided tour of the atrocities he had committed and admitting guilt at every turn.
Like, can you imagine that you are showing the federal police where you've buried people that you've murdered, and you're just like, "Actually, though, can I have a sandwich?" That doesn't make any sense. And then finally, the police asked where Mark Kilroy was buried, and Serafin Hernandez pointed to a wire sticking out of the ground and said that that's where Mark's body was. When asked what the wire was for, Hernandez explained that after Mark was killed, they stuck a coat hanger through his spine before they buried him, so that once he had decomposed, they could pull it out of the ground and El Padrino could wear it as a necklace. And I think it's really interesting that Gavito describes Serafin as being high on belief, You know, you hear those stories about like people who run into oncoming traffic because they're on like angel dust or whatever. It's like that, but he genuinely believes that he's totally untouchable because of a person, because what a person has told him. It's incredible.
It's the power of belief.
We aren't really going to dig into like the religious aspects of this. But what we're seeing here is that in these cult practices, it's a practical application of your belief system. Like if you see it working, you know, someone is sick and they get better, or someone gets a job, or they never get caught by the police when they're running an enormous amount of drugs across the border every week, you're going to try it if you see it consistently working. And how different is it really than praying for something? How big of a step is it?
Definitely. It's like you described it. It's the practical application of it. In many other religions, it's much more passive and it's much more, I'll pray, and the power of belief that prayer makes people feel better. And then they think that that will lead to, if you have enough faith, if you pray hard enough, if you believe hard enough, that that will lead to your desired outcomes. But in this, it's the next step. It's the practical side of it. It's much more proactive. I'm going to do this thing, make this potion, kill this person to get to the point that I want to have the thing that I want to happen. And it's like you said, there's just because there's causation doesn't mean there's any correlation. But because you watch some guy slash a chicken's throat and then the next day his grandma doesn't die, you can make that connection and say, oh, well, how about if I kill a guy? Will that mean that when I next carry 100,000 pounds of marijuana across the border, I won't get caught? If you believe that hard enough, it's almost like OCD and superstition. You know, when people are like, I can't walk under that ladder because something bad will happen to me. But nothing bad will happen if you walk under a ladder, apart from maybe the ladder might fall on you, but that's not because it's unlucky. Do you know what I mean? It's like superstition. It's exactly what it feels like.
Well, okay, I was going to say it's not. It was my mum went to a concert with a lady. I don't know how she knew her. And they were trying to decide which entrance that they should go into wherever this concert was. And this woman just goes, oh, God will decide. What? It's what? Like, are you... That's insane. Like, you can't make the smallest decision for yourself.
But it is almost like, I feel like people use it as a coping mechanism as well.
Whereas people will just be like, oh, inshallah, like it's, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's like remove every grain of responsibility from yourself. Like if God wills it to be, it will be. And therefore, if it doesn't work out, if it doesn't happen, then I don't need to feel bad about it because it wasn't God's desire. In this, it's almost the flip reverse of that. It's, I can make this happen. It's almost like a self-help book written by, I was going to say the devil, but a self-help book written by, who's an evil person? I can't think of what. It's like, you can do this. I believe in you. You can make this happen. You just need to kill this person. Bury him in the ground, make a necklace out of his bones, and then it will happen for you.
Did you ever watch that Derren Brown thing that was called Push?
I don't think I did watch that, no.
Basically, like, I can't go into it in too much detail. Basically, what happens is he uses all of these sort of mind control techniques, and it's all on film, and basically he convinces this person that it's okay to push another person off a building. And it's all fake and it's not real. But they did it with 7 people and only one refused to push this person off. Like, these people could be convinced in the space of about an hour to kill someone.
We're going off track, but, you know, the experiment they did with the people in the electric shock, where they had an actor in the other room and they were saying, keep turning up the voltage at which you're shocking the person next door. And the actor would...
I think it's the Mildrum experiment. Something like that.
Well remembered. And it'll be the actor next door yelps each time they get the shock. And they'll keep telling them, keep going, keep turning it up. And they can see that at the end result, it's like, I don't know, 300 volts or something. And they're told that that could kill that person. But as part of the experiment, we need you to keep going, regardless of what you're hearing next door. I'm wearing a white coat and I'm very official. I've got a clipboard and I'm telling you to keep going. Most of them did it, but most of them continued all the way to 300 volts, even though they'd been told that it could kill the person next door. It's crazy how much we'll go along with authority and how easily we can be brainwashed into doing things. It's terrifying.
Because you really like to think of as yourself as being having your own agency and your own free will.
No, we're herd creatures.
Pack animals.
We are. And that's why things like not just organized religion, so many other institutions, so many other things can allow people that want to conform and follow a herd to then become victims of exploitation. And that's sad. But anyway, back to the case.
Serafina Hernandez, under police instruction, began to dig up the bodies and explained to Gabito, Ayala, and the Federales that they had killed these people because they were worshipping. Ayala was able to arrest a further four members of this murderous cult on Hernandez's testimony, one of which was his kidnapped uncle, Elio, who seemed to be doing just fine. So I have absolutely no idea why it was a kidnapping situation just a month before. So these four men were brought to the ranch at Santa Elena and they were ordered to start digging up the bodies.
Why aren't they getting forensics people to dig up these bodies?
Excellent question. They even used like a tractor. So like there is no, this is not delicate crime scene analysis happening here. Genuinely.
A tractor? Fucking hell. That's so lovely. You dig it up. You put it there, you fucking dig it. No, that's not how you excavate a crime scene.
So they uncovered a total of 23 bodies. Some of them had their throat slit, and most of them had at least one vital organ missing. They all admitted to being involved in Mark Kilroy's abduction and murder in the same blasé way that Seraphine had, just without giving a single fuck.
And this really, again, reminds me of the Ripper cult that we talked about in Halloween Part 2. How casually they all just kept implicating themselves in it. They all just one by one admitted to being involved. It's so interesting. Cults are fascinating. These guys that had been part of this cult, these people that had been part of this cult, they'd been pretending to be policemen. They even had uniforms, badges and lights on their cars. And this is how they'd abducted their victims. They had approached Mark Kilroy when he was separated from his friends, showed him the badge and told him that he was under arrest for being too drunk. They handcuffed him, drove him to the ranch, blindfolded him with tape, and left him in the back of their car. He was fed by the caretaker of the ranch until the mysterious padrino ordered that Mark Kilroy was to die. It was clear from the state of Kilroy's body that he had been killed with a machete strike to the back of the neck. Oh, God. And when questioned, Hernandez and the others quietly admitted that it was all El Padrino. How convenient, the police thought. Obviously, the one who had committed the crime isn't here. Now, Gavito leaves for Brownsville, Texas, to tell John's parents what had happened to their son. And although Ayala had more confessions than he knew what to do with, he still had no idea why these young, educated men with good families were riding around Matamoros disguised as police officers and murdering people left and right. Further investigation of the hut, though, revealed that the metal pot in the middle of the floor was filled with bones, sticks, railway spikes, a horseshoe, a dead tortoise, and a human brain. I mean, what the hell? That's some recipe. I mean, what was even going on? And I just feel like the Rancho Santa Elena sounds like a really, like, nice place to go hang out. And yeah, come see our pot filled with bones, sticks, railway spikes, horseshoes, dead tortoises and human brains. The highlight of your trip.
Is it weird that I think the biggest curveball in there is the tortoise? Like, I was prepared for the human remains bit, but the tortoise just really threw me off.
I actually thought the railway spike was... That's so random.
So they didn't have any idea what was going on with this fucking cauldron either. And they also had no idea who was calling the shots. Who was El Padrino? Who was this guy who was convincing these young, intelligent men that abducting people was completely fine? So let's start with what we do know. What we do know is that we've got a group of people moving thousands of pounds worth of marijuana across the border. And according to Deputy Sheriff Gavito, it's quite common in Mexico for drug cartels to practice Santeria. And like, what's your first impression when you hear the word Santeria? What's the first thing that you think of?
Santa. Satan. No, it's very like Catholic sounding.
Exactly. So Santeria, like, I think it's actually quite well known. There was a bit in like The Orange Is the New Black had a bit of a Santeria subplot for a bit. It's not as, it doesn't sound as scary as voodoo does. It doesn't sound as threatening or as dark. What Santeria is, it's an Afro-American religion and it blends African shamanism with Roman Catholic iconography, which is really bizarre. So it's like African gods are given Roman Catholic saints' names.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because this is what happens so often during like times during slavery and during colonialism, where the West just went and obviously took over large parts of the world that had their own indigenous religions. And infiltrated that with Catholicism to be able to, you know, well, firstly, it's a big tick, easy missionary work done. And it's the combination of that. The indigenous religions in many places don't die. They just get absorbed into this Catholicism, and it gives birth to these sort of hybrid religions and hybrid belief systems, which is fascinating, like anthropologically speaking.
And yeah, so Santa Yerlik is reasonably well known, I'd say, and is practiced peacefully by loads of people. Not, it doesn't necessarily need to be linked with something dark. But it was revealed that what was being practiced at the ranch at Santa Elena was not Santeria, it was Palo Mayombe. So Palo Mayombe originated from what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Angola with the Bakongo-speaking peoples. And it was brought to Cuba by enslaved Congo people during the slave trade. So today, similarly to African diasporic religions like Santeria and Haitian Vodun, Palo Mayombe blends shamanic religious practices with spiritualism, magic, and Catholicism. And I've also seen Palo Mayombe, like, referred to as the dark side of Santeria, but Santeria has different origins. Its African roots are actually with the Yoruba people rather than the Congo people. So it is from, they do look quite similar, and I can see why Palo Mayombe and Santeria are often mistaken for two halves of the same whole, but they are different things. They have different origins. I think the idea of them being two parts of the same thing comes from, like, the definition of white magic. Like, Santeria tends to deal with white magic, whereas Palo Mayombe doesn't draw a distinction between types of magic, and it can be used to hurt people. And also, it's quite focused on quick gratification. Like, do this spell, do this thing, tomorrow you will have whatever you want. And Palo's religious function revolves around the Nganga.
And this is what the pot in the hut at the ranch turned out to be. The Nganga is a magical cauldron composed of different soils, stones, wooden sticks, tools, and bones. In this case, it's pretty heavy on the bones and the human remains side. The Nganga is seen as the microcosm of the world and contains a powerful pact between the spirit of the dead and the Mpongo, the force of nature, who rules the Nganga. The Paolo priest directs the spirit of the Nganga to perform works of magic, to heal, to curse, to make magical changes happen, or to make pacts with new initiates. And it's super Hollywood to borrow from loads of different African diasporic religions and slap a voodoo label on it. And it's also important to note that Palo Mayombe can and is practiced peacefully. Palo is very dead-centric. There is a significant focus on communing with your dead, your ancestors, for example. And you see that loads in religions.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, like, it has this quite dark appearance, but ancestor worship is in every country in the world. Like, communing with your dead is super common. So I don't think that's, like, I've seen it described as, like, necromantic and, like, all of that sort of stuff. It makes it sound worse than it is, I think.
There are religions that practice this, or, you know, not even religions, like, cultures that practice this even further than that. So I wouldn't say this is particularly dark. Like, there's tribes in Indonesia that still do things like they will dig up their ancestors' remains and redress them and reclothe them and rebury them, which is fascinating. And there's also, we were talking about it at work the other day, where somebody said there's even a tribe somewhere that used to eat the flesh of the dead even after they had been buried.
Yeah, I think I've heard
that. And
then
the problem was, then there were huge outbreaks of, like, essentially mad cow disease, because you're eating diseased, putrefying human remains. So don't eat grandma, don't eat anyone.
Whenever it's anything like this portrayed in a film, it's always, like, really terrifying. And people do call it voodoo. They call all of it voodoo, and it's not that. Just that's just a word that the West has picked for, like, something they don't really understand and looks a bit scary and involves, like, a chicken. Like, it doesn't, not necessarily it was, but there are similarities between Palo Mayombe and Haitian Vodun. So, like, for example, the origin of the word zombie and why we have this idea of zombies in our culture actually comes from a Haitian Vodun ceremony where they draw a pattern in the sand, and that calls forth a particular god. So each god has their own pattern, so you can choose which one you pick, and then that god will possess a person at the ceremony, and that's where the idea of zombies come from. And in Palo Mayombe, you can draw a signature on the ground next to your Nganga, next to your cauldron, and call forth a particular god or spirit that you would like to commune with. So there are similarities, and I can't, like, we can't sum up four entire religions in the podcast, but I think I might do a minisode on Haitian Vodun because it was quite heavily featured in my dissertation and it nearly sent me over the edge, so I might as well just milk it, I think. So look out for that. So as I said, Santeria features African gods as Roman Catholic saints and uses a lot of Catholic iconography. So I understand why people are afraid of it and see it kind of as a bastardization, because like if you're a Catholic person and you see Catholic iconography that you recognized being used to do something you don't associate with, it's going to ruffle some feathers. Like people don't like what they don't understand, especially when they half recognize parts of it, like it's too close for comfort. And that's why people are so scared of it, I think.
If, you know, more and more of this information starts to come out, as Serafin Hernandez and his associates explained, that El Padrino would send them out to find people to sacrifice to the Nganga. If he wanted to make the Nganga strong, he would send them out to find a strong man, for example. So El Padrino would kill him, slice off his muscles, and pour his blood into the Nganga to give it strength. El Padrino wanted to give his Nganga, however, youth, so he sent Elio Hernandez out to find a young child. He came back with a young boy, but because the boy was crying, El Padrino said that he would not use the blood because it would make the Nganga sad. But they killed the boy anyway, and they just went out to find another one. This level of brutality is what's just so unbelievable. They're like, we don't even need this boy. So it's not like they even feel like they're worshipping him or using him in some productive way. They're like, no, I don't want to use him. He's crying, but kill him anyway. Now, El Padrino wanted to make the Nganga more intelligent. So he sent his followers out to go down to the main strip of Matamoros, where he knew that students would be hanging out, to bring him back a medical student. This is where they found Mark Kilroy. And it was his choice of degree that singled him out. And it was his brain that was in the Nganga when it was seized by the police.
And now, the moment you've all been waiting for, I'm going to tell you who the fuck this El Padrino character is. His name was Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo, and he was born in Miami in 1962. He was the son of a 15-year-old Cuban immigrant called Delia González de Valles, who was regularly arrested for multiple crimes ranging from petty to cruel, including shoplifting, check fraud, grand theft, and even child neglect. She always escaped charges without probation. She barely got a slap on the wrist, really. And she credited Paolo Mayombe. She felt that her practice was protecting her from the authorities. She would enlist the help of her children, often using them as lookouts and thieves. At 6 months old, Delia had her son, Adolfo, blessed by a Haitian Paolo Mayombe priest, who claimed that he would be destined for great power, and even said that he was the chosen one. So since he's a baby, before he can talk, he's surrounded by this idea. He's surrounded by Paolo Mayombe, and also that he's special. And while Constanzo was still a boy, his mother moved them both to Puerto Rico, where just aged 10, Constanzo was an apprentice to a Paolo Mayombe priest. It's unclear exactly how long they stayed in Puerto Rico for, but Adolfo Constanzo was back in Miami just in time to fail his high school diploma. And I can just imagine, like, if you think you're the messiah, you think you're the dark messiah of Paolo Mayombe, like, you're not going to do chemistry, are you?
I don't think that chemistry was needed for the Nganga potions that he was making. And, you know, I think it falls pretty low on your list of priorities.
He was also gay. And in a Rolling Stone article I read, they described him as a known homosexual, which, like, I know it's 1989, but I really thought that the Rolling Stone would be a little bit more woke, but absolutely it not. It was known. It makes him sound like a sex offender. So, oh, he was a known homosexual hanging around in Mexico City. Like, what a weird... Disappointed, Rolling Stone. That's all I'll say.
In 1983, he moved to Mexico City and recruited his first two disciples, one of whom, Martin Rodriguez, would become his long-term partner. He read fortunes, told wealthy drug dealers the best times to transport their goods over the border, and freed them from curses. Aside from drug cartels, his clients also included government officials, police officers, doctors, movie stars, and even Interpol. Interpol? We're using these guys?
They take it very seriously in Mexico, man.
Jesus.
But that just shows you, like, that's how ingrained it is. Everyone's
and
at it.
And how high profile it was. How high profile it was as well. Now, Constanzo was racking up a huge list of wealthy and important people whose spells protected them from the police, bullets, and their enemies. His ceremonies became more and more extravagant. this was like the need to put on more and more of a show. You've got to kick it up a notch. You can't just sacrifice a chicken every time a government official comes over. Part of all of this is definitely being a showman, for sure. And this is when Constanzo started using human remains in his blood sacrifices. Constanzo was famous and he was raking it in. This gained him the devotion of his followers. He was even described by Anthony Zalavetta, a professor of anthropology and sociology at Texas Southmost, as the Pied Piper of Death.
Isn't that just the best name you've ever heard?
If I was going to be a cult leader, then yes. That would be the best name ever. Now, Elio Hernandez introduced the Hernandez gang to Constanzo. They were just small-time smugglers at the time, but about to hit the big leagues, and they needed protection. Elio asked Constanzo to be their high priest for the Hernandezes. They needed help. El Dubi, one of their foot soldiers, was wanted by the authorities in 1988 for a shootout. Elio asked Constanzo to be the high priest for the Hernandezes in exchange for a percentage of their profits. Constanzo agreed and promised them untold riches, invincibility, and that they would become bulletproof.
Like, he was making so much money in Mexico City. Like, the offer from the Hernandezes must have been massive. For him to leave Mexico City and set up permanently in Matamoros, which is like a border, it's not Mexico City, you know? Like, it must have been an enormous offer. There must have been something really great in it for him. There's a particularly horrible story. One of the graves was occupied by a young boy who's thought to be about 14 years old. And what had happened was, this is an example of just, like, the lengths these people are going to because of this man. Elio Hernandez had been instructed by Constanzo to find a boy for the Nganga, and he obliged. Constanzo ordered the followers to take the first boy that they saw, and they spotted this kid looking for a lost goat on the road near Rancho Santa Elena. They grabbed him quickly and put a bag over his head. They carried him back to the ranch, where Elio decapitated him without looking at his face. The body was identified by his family to be José Luis García. He had lived on the farm 2 miles up the road from Rancho Santa Elena, and he was Elio Hernandez's nephew. He could only be identified by the grey and green football top he was wearing, and the García family had been searching for their son for 3 weeks and had not managed to gain the attention from the media. And they gave, like, a really heartbreaking statement to the press when their son was found in his shallow grave. His mum says, "If it weren't for the Kilroy boy, none of the other men, including my son, would have been found." And, like, that's, you see this throughout the whole case. It's so typical, like, a white man with rich parents goes missing and suddenly the world gives a shit. And it has been really apparent in the research for this case, because the only evidence that I could find, really, for what happened to any of those 23 victims was the account of what happened to Mark Kilroy. And I'm sure the other victims' names were known, and maybe they were even noted down to the police, but I couldn't find a single article that lists all of the names of the bodies that was found. The only cause of death and name that we know for sure is José Luis García and Mark Kilroy. And I just think that's pretty fucking fucked. There are 21 other people part of this whole thing. And this got so much press. This was all over the world. And not a single article lists the name of the other people. They only care about Mark Kilroy. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. And this is why when we talk about the less dead, we don't even have to go down the extreme of being like, oh, this person was a sex worker living on the fringes of society, and that's why no one cared about them and they didn't have a family who loved them. All of these children that they killed, all of these people that they killed as part of this cult, I'm sure did have a family that loved them. I'm sure they went missing from homes. The reason they didn't care is because they weren't rich and they weren't white. And make no bones about it, like, that's the truth of the matter. Even there's, like, I can't remember what documentary it was, maybe it was a Madeleine McCann documentary I was watching, and this journalist said straight out, the reason everybody flocked to that case is because she was pretty, she was white, and her family were rich. Same with JonBenet Ramsey. Why is it that those names just roll off our tongue? And that person said, if the person that goes missing is a child, if the person that goes missing is white, and if the person that goes missing is a girl, that's front page news. Everyone else is collateral damage. It's fodder. It's whatever. And you're right, it's fucked up. Also, getting a list of all of those in the cult seems to be totally impossible to do. We have Serafin and Elio Hernandez, Sergio Martinez, David Serna Valdez, and Sara Alderte. There is no record of other people. But I find it hard to believe that there were just 5 of them. It's a massive fucking drug cartel moving hundreds of thousands of pounds of weed over the border into the US. And they do it with just a 5-man operation. I don't know.
And I kind of got the impression that, you know, these young men in there, and Sarah was in her early 20s as well, they're not the big guns.
No, and they don't have the experience or the know-how to pull this off. There's not five people doing this. But Sarah Alderte, by all accounts, was more powerful than any of the others within the cult. Sometimes they even referred to her as La Madrina, or the godmother. Now, remember what we said about Mexican students living totally different lives on either side of the border? This was it. At the University of Texas, Sarah Alderte was an honor student. She was on the volleyball team. Everyone liked her. But the second she crossed the Rio Grande, she became a totally different person. She was a witch, quote-unquote witch, whatever. She had been a loyal follower of Constanzo since he began practicing Paulo Mayambe in Mexico City, and by some accounts, she was the one to introduce him to the Hernandez gang. At several junctures in their interrogation, the suspects made references to the 1987 horror film The Believers, starring Martin Sheen, stating that Sarah Alderte had organized viewings of this film and they had all watched it several times. The reference to this film caused people to refer to the members of the murderous cult as The Believers, although I couldn't find any instance of them referring to themselves in this way.
Yeah, so for my sins, I watched that film. Oh, I love horror films. I think they are the best reflection of society you could possibly have, because it's what people are afraid of encapsulated. And this film follows Martin Sheen, and he gets tangled up with this sort of Santeria-affiliated brujeria cult that practice sacrificing young children in New York City to gain political and financial power. It is not a good film. But I did see a really interesting theory that Constanzo used the film The Believers to whip up excitement in his followers in the same way that Manson used the Beatles' Helter Skelter. And I thought that was really interesting. And in a search of Alderte's bedroom at her parents' house, revealed an altar in her bedroom displaying black candles, beaded necklaces, cigars, and a blood-spattered wall. And Sarah, like, she was instrumental in tempting the prey on the calle. Like, she's a woman. Like, of course it's going to be easier for her to lure in whoever they need. And the day after the graves were discovered, Alderte did not show up to school. She simply called to say that she would not be returning to class due to some personal problems that she needed to work out. And I'd say that 23 mutilated bodies is a pretty fucking large personal problem.
It's going to take more than a day. And it's not unusual for Mexican students to leave their social lives on the other side of the border. Roberto Cortino was one of Alderte's professors. The bicultural nature of Matamoros and Brownsville would have made this double life pretty easy to pull off. Once the murders in Matamoros and Alderte's involvement in them came to light, her peers at Texas Southmost began to remember some odd things about her that they had just shrugged off before. For example, she had a nice car and a nice phone, even though her family were not well off. She wore black all the time, and most interestingly, she insisted on organizing a screening of The Believers, after which she jumped up and began preaching the benefits of the occult. But everyone had been drinking, and the other students had just thought that she was trying to freak them out. It had never occurred to them that she was being serious. And as I'm sure you can imagine, parents in Texas were absolutely fucking hysterical when the news of the Matamoros murders broke out. Many even pulled their children out of school. There were overflowing town meetings all over. People were desperate to solve the issue of drugs, death, and the devil south of the border. A flurry of false rumors were even started that Satanists were planning to kidnap children in revenge of the Matamoros murders. And confusing Satanism with Paulo Mayambe or Santeria or voodoo is all too easily done. Now, Sarah fled Matamoros for Mexico City before the police could get to her. The police still had no idea where Constanzo was, though. Comandante Alaya consulted his own Santeria priest, who suggested that if they wanted to find Constanzo, they would have to hit him where it hurts and burn the Naganga.
So Ayala, along with a TV crew, returned to Santa Elena and burned the hut and the Naganga to the ground, leaving 23 crosses in the ashes. And later that same day, like, I love this idea of a Santeria priest has been called in by the police, and he said, okay, if you want to get him, this is how you get him. And then the same day, within hours, it all happens. Like, don't give me the face. So, later that same day at midnight, Gabito gets a phone call. They had found Adolfo Constanzo. He was in an apartment in Mexico City with his boyfriend Martin Rodriguez, Sara Aldarte, and El Dubi, who was our foot soldier who was in trouble and clearly had become a fan. So Constanzo had seen his Nganga being burned on the news and went absolutely mental. He totally lost it. He started to burn money on the stove of this apartment and throw coins out of the window, and that is what gave the game away. Again, we've got two versions of what happened next. Number one, Constanzo ordered his boyfriend Rodriguez to shoot him and then shoot himself moments before the Federales storm this apartment. The Federales allege that they found the couple riddled with bullets in a small cupboard. Doesn't really scream murder-suicide, does it? And, like, also, this is ridiculous. The Federales say that the faces of the two bodies in the Mexico City apartment had so many bullet wounds in their faces, apparently they could not be identified. I'm really not sure how, like, reliable that source is. And it feels like a bit more of, like, a legend surrounding it. Like, oh, well, they couldn't identify the body, so he could still be out there. He still could be alive. They don't know it was him. They couldn't identify the body. But the crime scene photo exists. I've seen it. They look pretty easily identifiable to me. Like, they make it sound like it's, you know, just a hole where a face is, and that's not the case at all. Like, you can clearly see who it is. So El Dubi and Aldarte are also present at this time. In this account, Costanzo ordered El Dubi to kill him and Martin, or that he would be punished in hell. So El Dubi stood on a stool and emptied his machine gun into the closet door, killing Costanzo and Martin. And that, to me, seems like the most likely scenario. I really, really, really do not buy the murder-suicide thing. So El Dubi and El Sara Aldarte were arrested and imprisoned.
And Mexican police also claim that in Mexico City they found over 40 more victims that they connected to Adolfo Constanzo. And that was that. Constanzo was dead in the apartment. Police found a book with all the names of the most important people he had worked his magic for. He had to die. Otherwise, he might have talked. I think this is why quite a lot of the details of this case are really fuzzy. Constanzo was involved with so many high-profile people.
That's why it all went quiet after it. They were like, oh, well, he's dead now. You know, no need to investigate this any further.
Yeah. But what amazes me more than that, though, is the young people like Serafin Hernandez and Sara Aldarte, just how they were taken in by Constanzo. So with Serafin Hernandez, Constanzo had done his job so well that he had this kid convinced that he could do anything. Because of his belief, the whole organization was brought down.
I think that is so interesting.
It is.
Like,
he just went and confessed everything because he thought nothing was going to happen to them. It's so ironic. He did his job so well in brainwashing Serafin Hernandez into thinking that nothing could ever touch them, nothing could ever hurt them. They would get away with it always. That led him to go just casually tell the police everything that happened. And of course, that's what brought them down. The question is, did they really believe? Or did they want the glamour? I mean, if you don't believe, though, are you going to be sacrificing humans?
Well, it's where do you draw the line? Like, I can see, like, if you want the money and, like, to be respected. You know, people do awful things for money and power. These are intelligent kids as well from, like, good families. Like, well, I suppose it's all about your mental state, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Some people are much more susceptible to this than others. And people who go after people to be in cults, etc., they know how to profile who is going to be a good victim and who's going to be compliant, who is susceptible to this kind of thing. What happens after this? The aftermath is all very tragic. Mark Kilroy's parents started an anti-drugs foundation in the wake of their son's death. His father, James Kilroy, stated in a press conference, "Mark never had any involvement in narcotics. He was afraid of narcotics, but it was the narcotics that killed him." When people sit there and tell you a marijuana cigarette doesn't hurt you, they're wrong. Marijuana is what killed Mark. These guys were marijuana smugglers. So let's have a think about this. So firstly, I know this is tragic, but I always find it really hilarious when people say marijuana cigarette.
It is funny.
It's just a joint. A marijuana cigarette. What is that? I guess I know what he means. And I don't know. He was afraid of narcotics.
When I first sort of read that, I was like, yeah, right, like marijuana never killed anyone. But what I do understand is that illegal drug smuggling is an enormous problem. It's the number one source of crime in Mexico. It's a problem. And I think that that's what he means, rather than like marijuana is the problem. It's the smuggling of it. Like, if there was no smuggling cartel, my son would still be alive.
Absolutely,
that's what he means,
you know,
I think.
He's not saying that his son died from an overdose of marijuana cigarettes. He's saying, you know, that marijuana as a product and what these people are willing to do for it is what killed my son. And, you know, I'm sure people have different views on this, but absolutely, fucking hell, just legalize marijuana, you'll kill the cartels.
I don't know, fucking legalize everything, man, and then you can regulate it. That's
absolutely
what I think.
You can control it. Maybe not like fucking meth or crack.
People will do it anyway. It's better that it's regulated.
I don't know. I wouldn't agree with it on like things like that, like meth, crack, amphetamine, stuff like that. But I think marijuana...
But you can get amphetamines as a weight loss drug.
I don't know if I buy the case for legalizing like meth. I think yes with marijuana, but no, I'm probably draw a line on legalizing meth.
Also, I came across, because I feel like we have been quite careful about like delicately talking about Palamayombe as like not necessarily a dark religion, and it being, it's like the misguided views of one select group that have caused this tragedy. And also, like, fucking show me one religion that doesn't have some sort of atrocity connected to it. Show me one. It doesn't
exist.
But what was really interesting was I came across like a Reddit Ask Me Anything situation from a Palamayombe priest. And one Redditor brought up Adolfo Constanzo and asked this priest whether he thought that Adolfo Constanzo was a true representation of Palamayombe. And this Palamayombe priest came back with, you know, he was a serial killer and he used Palamayombe because it was familiar. And if he was a Christian, he would have been crucifying or stoning people, which initially I thought was quite a good point. But now I think it's bollocks.
Yeah, I don't buy this. I don't buy this argument. As soon as a crime is committed and that person says, I am this religion and this is why I'm doing it, we're very quick to be like, oh, no. That person isn't anything to do with us. But they self-identify as part of your religion, and they have identified something in the teachings of that religion that has led them down this path. This is a problem. You have scriptures, you have writings from thousands and thousands of years ago that are open to interpretation. I was actually watching The Big Questions today on the BBC, which is a great show. I fucking love it. In which they were talking about, has the West misunderstood Buddhism? Aung San Suu Kyi is busy committing genocide, or at the very least endorsing genocide against the Rohingya Muslims. Oh my God, go read everything you can find about it, because it is an atrocity and the world is looking the other way. We're doing absolutely nothing about it because Myanmar is such a vital part of the world to control China, etc., etc., and no one is doing anything. She won the fucking Nobel Peace Prize and is now, you know, part of this genocide. This Buddhist monk in these questions is saying she isn't a Buddhist. She calls herself a Buddhist, and they're saying, no, but she grew up in England. She didn't live in Myanmar, so she's not really a Buddhist, a Burmese Buddhist. No, yes, she is, and that's why she's doing it. This is what religion does in many ways, in many places, is that it's the haves and the have-nots. She believes so fervently in her Buddhism, and she believes so fervently in their rights elevated above those of a minority like the Rohingya Muslims that live there, that word for word what the generals say there in this coup genocide they're delivering is that to kill a Rohingya Muslim isn't such a sin because they are half a person. And this is what religion does. It makes the ins and the haves, and it makes the outs and the have not. And then it becomes very easy, whatever religion you are, to do whatever you want. So yes, in the West especially, we grossly misunderstand other religions and what they really mean and what they can really do. Some of these just have very good PR departments.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's the sacrifice thing with Palamayombe that people don't like. But if you're a Catholic, you're very fine with literally eating the body of Jesus Christ. That's normalised for you. What, it's not that much of a far cry from killing a chicken being normalised, do you know what I mean? But what is interesting, so this priest in this AMA said that, you know, there's absolutely no human sacrifice in Palamayombe, and they only sacrifice animals. But I did come across a few websites that claimed to be, I am on so many fucking lists because of this podcast, I swear to God. I'm going to get, if I ever try and go to the United States again, they are going to stop me at Interpol. Anyway, I did come across a few websites that claimed to be selling legitimate human bones. These are Palamayombe websites. And one of them was even selling the skull of a human baby for $2,000. So I don't know how much I buy that there's no human sacrifice in Paolo Mayombe anymore. I don't know.
I would agree with that.
That's our Mexican...
That's an interesting case.
Killer cult.
This is an interesting case, and obviously I'm sure you guys won't agree with everything that we've said, but we know that you guys are smart. Anyone listening to this podcast, you guys know what you're doing. You're intelligent people.
Talk to us about it. Like, I know so little about Santeria and stuff like that. Like, and if you know, tell me. I love it. I'm fascinated
by
it.
Oh my God, absolutely. And if you have beliefs, if you're a certain way, please tell us, because like genuinely, we're not close-minded. We're not narrow-minded. We want to hear from you. We want to hear what your thoughts are, because it's only through that kind of diversity of thought and experience can we have a really good understanding of what people's belief systems are. I can only come at it from my point, and Hannah can only come at it from her past and her point. So let us know what you think, and let us know what's going on. We'd love to know.
And thank you for our new Patreon supporters. We have Tiffany Athens, Liddy Laurie, Claire Morrison, Petra Clinbeal, which is my favourite name in the world ever. Portia McDougal, also love that name. Jen Paradiso and Carrie Boy, who went from a $1 to a $5. Thank you very much, Carrie.
Thank you. And some very quick five-star review thank yous. We've got Nicola G85, who says she's a lover of true crime, and Red Handed are offering something completely different, not typical, and extremely well-researched. Oh, thank you, Nicola.
And I love this one. We've got Mark Rafferty, and I've looked up how to say it, so I think I'm going to say it right this time. Mark Rafferty says, Todd Murdens.
I don't think that's it.
I think that's right.
Somebody tweeted at us. They were like, for God's sake, it's Tumudden or something. Tumudden? Anyway, whatever.
That town that we can never pronounce. Favourite podcast. Mark Rafferty says it's an excellent podcast and hopes that we do a Harold Shipman episode. Dr. Death.
Mark!
Because he used to work in Tumudden. He's quite boring.
He is. He's even the police, when they were investigating it, he's probably got the highest body count of like a Western serial killer. But even the police, when they were investigating it, said he's one of the most boring serial killers ever. I get it. I get the like local love, but maybe he's a Minnesota. I don't think I can talk for an hour about Harold Shipman. Even his face is so boring. We also have a review from Shell, who says, love, love, love the podcast. Girls are great, fun, yet interesting and well-researched.
And our social media moment of the week. This was really touching, actually. Lovely Carlo, who's a member of our Facebook group, posted and said, you know, I don't use iTunes. Where can I review you? And obviously there are a lot of you out there who don't use the Apple Podcast app, which is completely understandable. So like Carlo, if you don't use iTunes, if you could post about us in any of the Facebook podcast groups, that would be incredible. That's what Carlo's done. And it really does help us so much. So if you felt that way inclined, that would be greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. And we'd never even thought about it, like Hannah said. But yes, I think Carlo posted very kindly in True Crime Podcast Group, or there is also Podcast We Listen To Group. Both those groups you should join anyway. And if you want to chuck us a review in there, we'd very much appreciate it.
And we will see you. We'll see you next week.
Bye.